Since 1937, Ducks Unlimited has been the leader in waterfowl conservation, with over 16 million acres of habitat conserved. DU supporters and volunteers have led the charge to fill the skies with waterfowl, today, tomorrow, and forever. You too can play a role in leaving a legacy for the future of waterfowl hunting. To find an event near you or to join our volunteer team, go to www.ducks.org/volunteer. Ducks Unlimited. Conservation for a continent.
Welcome to the Standard Sportsman Podcast. The show features trending topics, touching all aspects of duck and goose hunting in an effort to motivate others to leave the resource better than they found it. Hosts Cason Short and Brent Birch are lifelong Arkansas hunter conservationists, delivering thought-provoking discussions with engaging guests before, during, and after duck season. Thanks for spending time with us today. Now let's jump into today's show with the guys.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Standard Sportsman Podcast. I am Cason Short, joined as always with Brent Birch. Brent, you're on here today, so I assume you survived the eclipse. Nothing crazy happened where you were. What's going on in your world today?
Yeah, I did survive the eclipse. You know, we talked about it a little bit before we started recording. It was super cool to see that. I actually went to Lake Hamilton, which is in Hot Springs, Arkansas. We've got a little place over there, and it was cool to be on a lake. And, you know, since we talked a lot about ducks and geese, it was kind of interesting as things were getting, you know, that weird kind of hazy color, and then it gets darker and, you know, gradually gets to the totality part, because Hot Springs was right in the middle of all that. It was interesting to watch the Canada geese on the lake start gathering up, and then, you know, a group of, I don't know, 15, 20 got up and moved right before it got dark. And where we were, when it got dark, the wind completely died. And the wind was blowing pretty good, you know, decent on the lake, I'd say 8, 10 miles an hour. And then the water went completely flat, and then it got dark. So that was kind of cool.
Yeah, it was neat. I mentioned too before we started, you know, I'd been in some partial eclipses where, you know, you could view it with the glasses, but you really couldn't tell much on the ground. And I read lots of comments, you know, people that don't understand the hype and I'm not driving, no big deal, whatever. I will say, until you've seen it in totality, you're not really experiencing it. So if it ever gets close to you, give it a chance. It is pretty cool to see. And the wildlife was really a very interesting aspect too. We saw similar stuff, just kind of threw everything off. And I told my kids, they had kind of studied it and talked about it in school. And one of the things, my third grader, they had kind of talked about some of the ancient or old cultures and what they thought was going on, you know, how they explained eclipses. So I talked to them a little bit about that. I mean, imagine, you know, back in the time of cavemen, the one thing that separates day from night and brings you warmth and all these things, suddenly it goes away in the sky. Like, that had to have been unreal for that civilization, you know, in comparison to us. We know when the next one will be and can start planning now 21 years in advance. So it was pretty cool for sure.
Yeah. Wild stuff. Yeah, I can imagine being back then. That'd have been something out of nowhere. All of a sudden the sky gets dark. No prediction models back then.
Yeah. And then the temperature swing was really, I mean, we're not talking midsummer, but I think it was 83 when it started, you know, early first started to eclipse. And then by totality, we had dropped like 7 degrees in temperature, which was, I mean, pretty substantial to me. Definite felt difference there. That was pretty neat.
Yep. Yeah. We felt the same.
Yeah. Well, enough about that. Let's talk about ducks and some other stuff of interest. Tell everybody who's joining us today.
For over 30 years, Lyle Real Estate has been connecting land investors and outdoorsmen with sellers. Whether looking to invest in an income-producing farm or recreational land, the Lyle Real Estate team has the connections and the expertise to help. They work with tracts of all sizes and specialize in agricultural, timberland, and recreational properties. New listings are hitting the market almost weekly, so head on over to their website to learn more. www.lylerealestate.com.
Yeti. From the legendary hard coolers to the new barware series, Yeti has you covered. Or check out one of my favorite new products from them, the Loadout Series Go Box. Yeti, built for the wild.
Yeah, we've got one of our repeat guests on today. Got Dr. Doug Osborne, which a lot of our listeners are familiar with based on our earlier episode. Plus, you know, we've kind of drawn a fan base that is interested in a lot of things that, that Doug tracks and talks about and everything else. But yeah, welcome back to the show, Doug Osborne.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it. Look forward to the conversation.
Yeah. And I figured, you know, Casey and I've been talking about it, and we figured it was appropriate to bring you back on now that we're past duck season, and now we're past the field work of your winter banding efforts, which you know, have gained a lot of information to share with hunters, and then those guiding policy and rules and regulations and everything else. But you know, I thought it was kind of interesting. I was looking up some numbers before we came on, and it's incredible to me, kind of the swings in the banding efforts that have gone on over time. You know, Arkansas, a lot of people kind of associate these banding efforts that are going on in state on the wintering grounds is kind of a new thing, but actually we did more back like in the 60s and then again in the 80s, and then it went completely flat. Looking at some numbers around 1990, and really didn't pick up again until 5, 6, 7 years ago. And now the number just kind of keeps climbing because there's your efforts, and there's a few other pockets of banding efforts around here. But I think what's important, and this is kind of where I want to start the conversation, is, you know, kind of at a high level, what the importance is of these winter banding efforts and why it's so valued, but also how much we're doing here and how little is being done where they spend the spring and summer. Because I looked up, you know, the ducks, most of the ducks that are alive now, let's say they were born 2020 through 2023, which is when the data ran out. So the last, you know, last 3-4 years, Saskatchewan, Alberta, and Manitoba have only banded 561 more mallards than the state of Arkansas has over the same time period. So a little bitty Arkansas compared to those provinces in Canada where all the ducks are funneled into those areas pretty much, we've done exponentially more banding. So to kind of kick the conversation off, you know, what's going on there? You know, is it funding? Is it lack of people to research? And then the value of what we're doing here with the winter banding projects.
Yeah. Good way to start this off. I think it's good that people understand sort of the history of where we've been and why we're where we're at now. You mentioned, you know, winter banding occurred a little bit in the 60s here, and then it kind of fell off, and again in the 80s. And so, traditionally, what I'm doing here on this wintering banding project is really a non-traditional banding operation, right? And so, I mean, traditionally, the bands were all put on the breeding grounds. We start putting these bands on the breeding grounds, and that's how they learn the flyway system, right? They start getting all these recoveries, and they start to draw out and pattern out what these flyways look like, and that there are some patterns in the distribution where these birds go. And so early on in the bandies, I'm talking about in the 40s and 50s, you know, this stuff really started. And so all the banding was done on the breeding grounds because they were easy to catch. Birds were super concentrated in certain areas of wetlands. They could catch them easy. And then, you know, 15, 20 years into banding, they said, hey, wait, what about catching them on the wintering grounds? What can we learn from that? It's a different sort of data that can, or different inferences from the data that can come out of stuff that from the bands on the wintering grounds. So they had little efforts that really focused on the White River National Wildlife Refuge for the most part, federal efforts to band in Arkansas during the 60s and then again in the 80s. Ultimately, what happened was in the formulation of hunting policy and regulations, they never really figured out a way to use the data from the winter banding to drive the harvest in population models. If you think about breeding on the summer, on the breeding grounds, the traditional breeding grounds, as soon as birds are done breeding, they're building energy reserves, they're getting ready for migration, and hunting season starts nearly immediately after banding up there. So if they band them in August and September, and hunting season starts in September, in a mark recapture analysis model, they assume that 100% of the birds that they put out with bands are alive and available for hunters to harvest them. And so it's the methods is feeding the assumptions of the model that they use to analyze the data. So they know all the bands are alive. They put them out there and they're available for hunting. So if 10% of them get harvested, then we assume there's maybe a 10% harvest rate. So for a long, long time, they just really use preseason band data for this. When they established the banding locations on the prairies originally, they put these permanent buildings smack dab in the middle of where the mallards were nesting. And they put all these stations across Manitoba, Alberta, Saskatchewan, Ontario, and they located right in the middle of where all the mallards were. 30, 40 years later, what we see is shifting mallard distributions on the prairies. And so where there used to be 90% mallards breeding, now there's 90% blue-winged teal and the mallards are somewhere else. But they have the permanent banding stations established and they have to use them for the crews and stuff to live out of. So now they're not really banding in the middle of the mallard range for the most part. And so a lot of their efforts are that they're catching non-mallard species in areas that they used to catch mallards. So we see a shift in their breeding distribution, all related to the condition of the wetlands and the prairies up there. And so because the mallards shifted, we see less and less mallards banded through time. From the 60s to about the 90s, where banding in the prairies sort of peaked out, the peak numbers, they were banding 25,000 mallards in Saskatchewan a year on the breeding grounds during the 1990s. And now it's, you know, less than 5,000. And so that decline in the number of bands on the breeding ground is one driven by priorities and funding, right? We get to the point where we think we have all the data we need for mallards. And the people that are funding the banding program say, oh, we understand population dynamics of mallards. We don't need any more, and we're going to prioritize this funding and use it somewhere else. Okay. And, you know, and the fact that they shifted. And so funding is one of the main issues and effort on the breeding grounds. It's hard. Birds are scattered across an enormous landscape. So it's hard to catch big numbers now because of wetland conditions, because of funding, because of efforts and manpower and that sort of thing. And so the reason, I think one of the major reasons for, we're wintering a large proportion, of course, in Arkansas and the Mississippi Alluvial Valley, a large portion of the mid-continent population of mallards. And so you think about these mallards breeding all across the prairies, and they all pile into a bucket down here in Arkansas, and we get higher densities of birds. So now we really are catching just as many, if not more, mallards in Arkansas in 20 days than they do across the prairies during pre-banding season or pre-hunt season. The winter banding sort of stopped in the 80s because they weren't using the data. And this is this is traditionally how agencies work. If they're just, they're not proactive. They don't envision needing that data down the road. They're like, okay, well, we know we have a good understanding of mallard population dynamics. Populations in the 90s were really super high. So why should we spend the money to monitor these birds? But then in hindsight, when populations fall as low as they are now, now we got a huge gap in the data that we can step backwards and look to see what happened, right? And so that's why our program started, because they banded in the 60s in Arkansas on the winter ground. They banded in the 80s. And we started as a mechanism for monitoring, right? We don't know when these data are going to come important. You know, we've been banding for 12 or so years now, and all of a sudden now the flyways are interested in our data. Whereas 12 years ago, they were fighting me about doing the work in the first place. And so now all of a sudden it's important. Now, because we have stronger computing power, we have better statistical tests and modeling practices, and we got some really smart population ecologists and waterfowl that can learn now to use this data so that we can use the winter data to drive harvest regulations, which hasn't been done in the past.
How much is this data set that you and others that do the wintering banning, how much is that being used currently to guide either AHM, which trickles down to rules and regs and frameworks and everything else? I mean, is it in play right now, or is it still just a data set that's out there, but it's not really active?
It's not being used for policy and harvest or survival estimates. And so this is what, moving forward, you know, we talk about AHM and how the objectives of that is really focused around the hunting opportunity, not the resource. If we move into managing waterfowl populations and managing the waterfowl hunt according to this, to the level of the resource, if the resource declines, then we back off. If it increases, you know, maybe we can hunt more. If we change our objective of harvest management to focus on the resource, and we have better understanding and estimates of survival rates and harvest rates, and when survival is low and harvest is high, then we can make adjustments to our hunting policy. Then it's at that time that our data will be hugely valuable. Okay, so think about what we get from preseason banding. We ban these things, these mallards on the prairies. We put fresh bands on them. Hunting season starts 3 days after you band them, and they get harvested from September 1 all the way to January 31st, okay? And so we're getting data from these, we're getting feedback and data from these bands all the way to the end of January, but we know nothing about the survival of these birds after February 1st all the way till we start banding again. So there's a portion of the annual cycle that we really don't get any data from in terms of population dynamics. My program now, that immediately when we're banding, so we're banding immediately after hunting season. So now all of a sudden there's a fresh new bunch of birds banded. We know exactly how many we banned February 1, and we want to see how many is alive come next hunting season. And so now we can learn about survival patterns of mallards during the non-hunting season, right? And so if I put out 1,000 bands and 100 of them get harvested next year, and you know, I got a 10% harvest rate of my bands, and we do that over, you know, cumulative over 14 years, like we've been doing, and we run a full blown true survival estimate analysis, it's going to tell us years that we may have lower lower natural survival or sort of higher mortality on the breeding grounds. And that's really what I'm trying to get at moving forward. I just hired a young lady from Michigan. She'll be coming here. She'll actually going to be working for me, start this analysis this summer. But we really want to look at that rate of natural mortality. What's happening to these birds between the end of hunting season through next, you know, the start of hunting season next year. So if we learn about the patterns in survival in natural mortality now and compare it to what the data showed us back in the 60s and the data in the 80s, what I'm expecting to see, my hypothesis is that we got higher levels of natural mortality of hen mallards during the non-breeding season. That's what I'm expecting to see. And so that estimate of survival goes into all the modeling estimates that Fish and Wildlife does in terms of understanding basically the population dynamics and how many birds they expect us to be able to harvest to maintain the levels that we want to maintain in a population. And so those survival and harvest estimates are going and should in the future help guide our policy. But we don't know what survival and mortality levels are during the non-breeding season because we're not monitoring them until now. And so I think our program has picked up a lot of speed. I think people are finally recognizing the value of proactively monitoring stuff, because we don't know what's going to happen 10 years down the road in terms of populations. We're going to get 10 years down the road and may have a population crash, or we may have it, you know, through the roof. And to look back in time to see what factors drove that population to decline or what factors drove that population to increase, if you're not monitoring it, you don't know what you've done right or what you've done wrong. And so this is an active monitoring program that allows us to adaptively manage the population. If you're not monitoring it, you can't adaptively manage it.
Hey, Doug, before we, I definitely want to get into hen mortality. That's a really big portion of what we want to talk about today. But I want to back up for a second and give you an opportunity to kind of explain something that our guests probably don't know about or don't understand. So occasionally, Brent and I catch a little heat for questions we ask or things that are said. And we have no intention of being accusatory of anyone, but there are two different trains of thought kind of in waterfowl management currently. You know, there's kind of the old school hardcore data scientists. This is the way it is. We have the data, everything's good. And then there's people that are beginning to think maybe we should update some methods, maybe something's wrong, maybe just asking questions. So Brent and I obviously fall in more in the category of asking questions, but I know, having done some banding with other biologists and kind of been in and around your circle for a while, that early on you caught a lot of flack for your efforts and for your research. And if I'm not mistaken, a lot of the decision makers were pretty dismissive of your project. And now it seems, as you said, they're wanting your data. They want what you're doing, because, you know, some of these banding sites were shut down after COVID and never reopened. U.S. Fish and Wildlife and Canadian Wildlife Services aren't banning the number of birds they used to. So your data is now very valuable to them. But if you would explain that a little bit, kind of the differences maybe in kind of the old school federal efforts, your a little more private funding efforts. Talk a little bit about that and about maybe the different mindset between these different research groups or different biologists, because I don't think our guests fully understand that there seems to be a little bit of a split forming between the opinions of the decision makers.
Ooh, baby, you're going to open a can of worms.
That might be the only thing we talk about from here on.
Yeah, that's okay. Y'all seen my slide before with my friendship, my recent last few years of friendship circle, right? I had 4 or 5 friends, you know, 5 years ago. Then I had 3 friends. I had 2 friends. And now the only friend I got is the mallard duck. So, so let's open the can of worms. That's okay. So, you know, traditionally, I think I will say, you know, that traditionally the banding operation is funded by state and federal agencies. In terms of the Flyway Council, the technical committee in the council, it's made up of all the different, every state within the Flyway. It's made up of the federal government. It's made up of the nonprofit organizations associated with waterfowl, like Delta and the DU. And so they all have a seat at the table in the Flyway Council. And so in terms of the banding operations themselves, they're really sort of, they were traditionally under the realms of the feds and the states, right? And so the states really had kind of the responsibility to do the banding. The states fund the banding. And so all the states in the Flyway actually contribute funding to fund the banding, the banding program up on the prairies. And so if 50% of the bands are harvested in Arkansas, then Arkansas is mathematically are supposed to be contributing 50% of the funding for that. And so, and I may be off a little bit on those numbers, but the more bands that are harvested in your state, that's how they determine how much your state needs to support the banding efforts on the breeding grounds. This is when They knew they needed band data. They knew they needed recoveries of bands so that they could generate estimates of population abundance using Lincoln-Peterson estimates and those sorts of things. And so, historically, it was, you know, some researchers had some, right, were able to get banding permits for certain things and various things if they were very targeted research projects. So I would venture to say that it's slightly, it's a stomping grounds issue. I'm just going to say it because I'm a researcher that people thought had no objectives for my study. They thought I was recreational banding for fun when I did have objectives. My objectives were comparing survival and harvest rates of birds from the 60s, 80s to now. That's the science that really drove my original banding. My original banding also on a second pillar is to train these biologists that are coming out of this building that are going to work for these agencies. These kids have to be trained somewhere. If they don't have the training in graduate school, when they're applying for jobs with these agencies, they don't have the experience. Their resume is not coming to the top of the stack. And the third pillar of this banding program was engaging the public that deserves to be engaged in this stuff. The public, we are in an era of information. Everybody wants to know more. They want to know where their bands come from. Back in 1950 and 60, half the people that harvested a band never called it in because they didn't trust the federal government. Now people are standing in the marsh submitting their data because they want to know the information. As a hunter, we fund this support, or we fund this the sport of hunting, and we deserve to be better informed about the science and stuff that drives the decisions that are being made. And people want to know that. And so that third pillar is that outreach part. The state agencies are concerned about selling hunting licenses. I promise you, when I'm taking 10-year-old kids out banding ducks, it's going to help to make an impression on them about the sport of duck hunting. And we hope that it will help continue to sell hunting licenses into the future. And so there's really the science, the training, and the outreach part of this program that's essential to the success of waterfowling in the future. And so I really, truly believe that there's a select group of folks that weren't real excited about my program because they didn't see the science, they didn't see the need for the data. But now all of a sudden, you know, 10 years later, when our populations are as low as they are and tanking, now all of a sudden the information is valuable. And so this is what I teach my students in a sample and monitoring class. Listen, you can't adaptively manage anything if you're not monitoring the actions that's going on in that process. And so we teach a habitat management class here, and you're consistently monitoring the plants that are coming up in your moist soil. If you're not out there monitoring the plants and you get a crop of undesirable plants coming in and they get too far gone, you can't flood them, kill them or you can't get in there at some time to set that succession back. So you are constantly monitoring. And that's what I think the value of this program brings, is that value now to look back and we have 10 years of data. We don't have to say, oh man, we need a banding program now. We need to ramp up banding now because populations have been tanking for 10 years. You know, we know we need long-term data to address some of these questions. And so I think that's, you know, I think that's some of it. But we've had some retirements in the Flyway Council. And so I think some of these new generation of biologists that are coming up that are starting to lead, I think they see the new technologies. I think they see the new statistical techniques. I think they see the value of some of this data and science to help improve our waterfowling sport.
Yeah, I mean, I think early on, and you would attest to this, a lot of the the transmitter, these GPS units that were going out, a lot of there were some people that were very dismissive of those projects just because of the sample size and the transmitter effect, as they call it. But yeah. I think, you know, you're on the right track. The cutting edge technology with these things, and we're getting so much more data than the typical, you know, aluminum leg band that gives you basically two data points in a normal mm-hmm. harvest. So
yeah,
it's good to know that people are coming around to it and are beginning to be more accepting of the research you're doing, because I think it's very crucial. It's very key, and it's giving us a lot of insight on hen mortality. So that's the next topic we want to get into, right? We're seeing, and you're seeing it. We talk about these sex ratios and your explanation for that. I'll let you explain it here, but it is typically that hen mortality on the nesting ground is substantial, maybe more so. Would you say more so than what AHM accounts for?
Let me just throw a disclaimer that's my hypothesis. I think that there's some level of higher level of mortality going on with hen mallards now than there has in the past. I think that's where my trends are going. Because the ratio that we catch during a banding season doesn't match at all the ratio that we're harvesting in the encounter ratio is really, really growing. And so we were only so the most recent data that I'm looking at here now, and I got some numbers from just this banding season alone, but in 2001, we were catching five on the wintering grounds. We were catching five drake mallards to every one female mallard. And when we started this program, it was like 1.5 mallards drakes to every female. And then in 2021, the harvest was 15 drakes. This is a hard graph to explain without people actually seeing it. We're harvesting, I mean, they reported 15 drakes to every one hen, where we banded 5-1. In 2015, we were catching 1.5 drakes, but we were harvesting 3. And so that's only, you know, we were harvesting basically, we were catching twice as many hens in 15, and we were harvesting. We're catching three times more hens in 21 than we were harvesting. So that the rate of change is increasing to where we're seeing that proportion of hen to drake ratio get bigger and bigger and bigger as the years go on. And so I didn't do a great job explaining that. It's hard. It's really a graph is very simple, but it's almost something you need to look at. But the concern, my concern is what's happening to those extra hens that aren't showing up back up in the harvest. And I just truly believe that there's some level of mortality that's going on outside of the breeding, or during the breeding season, after February 1 to the breeding season. And so that's where this survival analysis that I'm about to start doing, I got 12 constant years of survival. So if I put out 10, if I put out some bands this, you know, in 2015 and they haven't been harvested yet, I may get 6, 8, 10-year-old bands harvested this year. And so I can give you a direct harvest rate, which is I put them out, you know, this February, and they're harvested next February. That's the direct harvest. But the indirect harvest is what's really important. So how long are those hens living after they're banded before they're harvested or recovered again? And so that takes every bird into account that we've ever banded. And that's what we have not yet done, mostly because we know we need larger data sets to look at this through time. 1 or 2 years of data in a banding program doesn't do you any good at all. And so now that we got 12 years, now that we are all looking at the hen mallard like something might be going on, it's absolutely time for me to run this. And so that's that's what my new student will be doing. She'll be starting May 1st. As soon as she's done with her finals up there, she's going to come down to Monticello for a couple of weeks. We're going to get her data and get her a bunch of objectives to start working on. She's a statistic whiz. And we're just really excited about some of the things that are about to come out of this study from her work on the last, 12 or so years of abandoned data here. So I truly expect to see lower levels of survival of the birds that we banned in February, specifically hen mallards. I expect to see lower survival rates of the hen mallards in this last 15 years than we did in the 60s and we did in the 80s, because we're going to analyze all that data and we're going to compare those different decades. And we expect to see lower survival during some of those eras that populations were higher, or the amount of CRP on the ground was higher, or the rainfall was higher up there, or the snow melt was higher. So once we figure out what those survival estimates are for those different decades, then we start pulling in factors that we think might be affecting survival, like snowfall and rainfall and prairie wetland conditions and the amount of CRP grasslands, and see all these different layers of data under there that we can model to see what one of those factors or multiple factors may be driving that change in survival.
Well, that'll be super fascinating to find, decades ago, similar conditions, to see if, the hens were getting hammered on the prairie pothole region because it was dry, or we saw similar numbers when it was wet, and whatever it's going to end up being, because all these data points are going to pull some things out and make it really recognizable. But that'll be fascinating to see, if there has been changes, or is it a direct correlation to those things? So okay. So your hypothesis is, the hens are really having a tough time, not necessarily because of a hunter pulling the trigger on them. So with that and what you're seeing in the field, where do you stand on the, we talked about a little bit about this when you were on previously, that, hunter mortality when, the bee pop is around 10 million, probably not that big a deal. Hunter mortality when the bee pop is at 6 million and declining, it probably is a factor. Is there any concern from your side of things that we should be backing off two hens in the limit, or is it still not at a point that it matters?
Okay, so my data, right, analyzing the survival stuff from my data, we're going to look at survival during the non-breeding season, or during the breeding season, and then we can use the prairie bands that were put up on the breeding season, on the breeding grounds. We can use that to look at mortality and survival rates of hens during the hunting season, right? And there's some, what we need to understand, and I think some people may have a good grasp on this, is what does survival rate, how does survival rate play of hens play into population dynamics? Like, what role does that have, right? Like, do we need to maintain, less than 3% harvest of our hens, or, less than 3% mortality during the breeding season and less than 3% hunting mortality? And we expect that to give us good response in the population. Or what are those numbers? What if we got 5% natural mortality and 3% harvest mortality on the population? How does that impact population growth? That's what we need to know, right? How does that directly impact the population growth? And what do those survival or mortality rates of hens need to be at to get population to increase? And if it's, and this goes back to the argument that it has nothing, it has nothing to do with the hen mortality. It's all prairie ponds and da 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 da. Well, again, your question is, at some point when it gets this low, it has to contribute to at some degree, but I'm not exactly sure how much it contributes, right? And so, in my opinion, give the girl a chance. I mean, if we're gonna, like, just let her go, give her a chance. If a raccoon's gonna kill her on the prairies, let her, give her a chance to make it back to the prairies. And so, it's not that hard. I mean, they're brown ducks versus green shiny ducks. And so I think the bottom half of the flyway, we should all be just saying, let's give her a chance, even though maybe the mathematical models say it doesn't matter. Well, I'm not going to be the one to, you know, to decide her fate if I got a choice. And so that really is a population ecologist's question. And I think we got some really, really cool, really smart young people that are in the waterfowl world that are really good with their population ecology, their statistics. I got a statistics background, but I'm not a population ecologist. And so I think we're going to see some groundbreaking, absolute groundbreaking analysis out of some of these guys that are working on this stuff. And I'm hoping that our data can help them inform the population dynamics to where we can actually think about harvest in terms of the resource.
Well, let me finish one thought on that.
Yep.
Because that's what, you know, hunters, I mean, you can talk to scads of hunters and they know what they see with their eyes, and they know these last couple seasons, and especially this last season, you're just seeing so, I mean, there are, you're not seeing, you're seeing so many more drakes and the hens are not with them. And, you know, sometimes, you know, the hunter's eyes don't lie. Sometimes we don't know what we're looking at. We don't know if we're looking at 10,000 birds or 5,000 birds. But, you know, you watch over your decoy spread and what's working, your block of woods or your farm or whatever it is, and you're just seeing exponentially more drakes than hens. It makes you worry and wonder. And then, you know, we've alluded to it a few times on the show, but there was a slide that a reputable waterfowl scientist posted or put up in his presentation that said there may be only be 1 million mallards in the mid-continent population, which is, that sounds like a really low number to me.
A million hens.
A million hens. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah, a million hens. You're correct. But anyway, so that, I mean, that's, to me, that's kind of scary. And I've lived by the rule, the hens fly on. I just don't shoot them. And of course I have shot some. I'm not saying I'm just totally never pulled the trigger on one in my life, but I definitely go out of my way because I believe the only way you can get the population back up is to get some prairie pothole region right, and for those hens to go up there and make babies. And if we're taking them out of the equation, how's that going to happen? So I guess I say all that to say, you know, the hunters are starting to see it too. It's becoming noticeable that something's not right about the ratios.
Well, you know, Brent, that was something that I wanted to kind of point out too. You know, you hear it said that harvest regulations don't produce ducks, and you hear tons of people, you know, well, you can't stockpile ducks. It's all habitat. It's all nesting habitat. And they're not wrong. Like this whole thing's really driven on mayponds. We know that. We're not arguing that. But I think we would all agree when you look at regulations that are being set 2 years in advance, when we're setting this hen harvest, in 2 years, we could be seeing the breeding ground recovering, right? So if it is recovering and we're not sending more hens back because we're still harvesting with this older mindset that you can't stockpile, then what if we were sending back twice as many hens? What if we had cut it back to one hen? Now we're sending twice as many hens back to the nesting ground. And I know it wouldn't be twice as many. You'd have to factor mortality, hunter harvest, all those things. But you would be sending more back, and you'd be sending them back to a breeding ground that was in an improving state, an improving condition. So now you're not trying to stockpile them. You're just speeding up the rebound process. But it's like, nobody considers that option. It's all just stats driven. But the hypothetical situation is it's possible. If this thing, and it will recover, it's going to come back. This is not, you know, it should recover. But if we're sending more hens back, if we practice some self-restraint, we can speed this process up.
Yep. Yeah, I definitely agree. And in the prairie wetlands, we know the patterns are cyclic up there on the prairies, and they've always have been, and the birds will recover, and they can recover rapidly. Populations can recover rapidly. And so the lower the number of hens gets, you know, the slower that exponential growth curve of the population growth back up to what we want it to be, the slower that happens. And so I agree 100% that we all should just do our best to give that hen a chance, no matter what the models say, because we know these models if our models, let me just say this, if our models in science are as good as the Weather Channel sometimes, we're in trouble. And so, for real, the weather, you think about the weather models that they put out every day. These are predictive models that's using data to make predictions about what's going to happen, and they miss the boat sometimes. Statistical models, that's the nature of modeling. And so we are making some assumptions about data that goes into the models, and there's uncertainty in that data. That weakens the strength of those models. And so, and we know that, but it's the best we have at the moment. And so, so we can't hang our hat on them, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they've got a much bigger data set and sample size than we do with waterfowl. So that's a good point.
Yeah.
The Standard Sportsman Podcast is brought to you by the following sponsors. Waterfowl hunters deserve to have a set of waders that can excel year in and year out throughout the duration of the season. So Sitka Gear set out to build the best pair of waders ever. Constructed from Gore-Tex Pro Laminate, the face fabric offers added durability and is breathable in active working conditions while completely sealing out the elements. Importantly, they proudly stand behind all of their Delta Zip wader features with their 100% serviceable guarantee. And I'm speaking from experience as I have sent my original pair of Sitka waders from the 2018 season back twice without a hiccup. Engineered to outwork, outlast, and outhunt everything else in the market, the Delta Zip Wader from Sitka Gear is the gold standard for reliability. The Chatham Jacket from Tom Beckby features a durable, weatherproof 8-ounce waxed shelter cloth shell that develops a great-looking patina with use. I've actually worn this jacket the last couple of seasons and appreciate the shorter cut to it, so it fits great inside my waders. It's also a really good weight for most Arkansas days afield. So if you like to mix a little vintage look with your technical gear waders, this is the jacket. You can find the jacket online at tombeckby.com. You can also find it in their brick and mortar locations in Wilson, Arkansas, Birmingham, Alabama, and the new store in Oxford, Mississippi.
Well, let's kind of shift gears on the hen, because I think a lot of people, and I do think a lot of people that listen to our show are in the same camp regarding trying to really limit the harvest of hens, but you see some other stuff around, and you know, this desire to chase limits and everything else, that sometimes those piles of brown ones get pretty high. And then of course that's all you see coming out of Canada, and you can't tell whether drakes or hens in the pile, but you see a lot of brown ones there too. But you know, that's why I wonder if the only way to really police this is to change the limit versus just trying to change a mindset, because that's kind of where we seem to be. But let's talk a second about, you know, some of the recovery stuff that is showing kind of the site fidelity and all of that. With, you know, I know you've got a slide that's showing a slight shift north with where some of the recoveries are coming from. But, you know, a lot of hunters like to talk about east or west and all these other things. And we saw some kind of goofy stuff with your, some of your birds during this, you know, pretty significant freeze we had in January. So maybe talk a little bit about what you're seeing with some of that recovery data, you know, shift wise, and kind of clear the air on what's actually showing up, because I know there's banding data that supports, you know, what you're going to say, and then you've got telemetry data that's going to support what you're going to say, but kind of clear the air maybe on some of what you're seeing.
Yeah. Yeah, we definitely have trending recovery analysis that shows a trending northward shift, particularly during December and January, because if you break it down by month, those are the, you know, December and January, we are seeing an obvious shift north in the recovery distribution of our banded birds. And we're not the only analysis that's shown that. There's some recent publications out that have also shown the same thing in the mid-continent population. And so that's been really interesting. Yeah. And so in terms of our, in terms of the phylopatry sort of thing, you know, we did an analysis a few years ago that looked at those indirect recovery or the direct and indirect recoveries. So all recoveries, we had 28% of all of our birds harvested or banded. 28% of those mallards were harvested within 100 kilometers, which is a pretty big area, honestly, of, you know, the Mississippi Delta is not that wide. And so it's a pretty big area within 100 kilometers of that banding site. What was really sort of interesting in, oh, this is all recoveries. The ones that were harvested and recovered in the winter, 52% of indirect recoveries were harvested within 50 kilometers of the banding site. So this is over half the birds that were, this is indirect, which means 2 years after they were banded. So banded, they go up north, they come back, they don't get harvested that first year, then they go back to the breeding grounds a second time, and they come down the second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth year after we banded them. So this is indirect recoveries, which is really interesting. So this is 2 years, like this bird made two annual cycles and then came back and was harvested within 50 kilometers of where we banded it. And so that's over half of the birds. And so that really points to me, that phylopatry question. Once they make two or three migrations and they're still coming back to that same area, that's where really, really, to me, was an eye-opening figure. That level of phylopatry within how far of a distance they were being harvested or located, you know, they used to call it, they analyzed it in the past as homing rate. And that homing rate back in with the data from the 60s was up at 70% of the birds were coming back to that same area. Whereas when we used our data, we found more like about, you know, 50 or 60%. And so over the years, we're seeing, it appears that we're seeing less and less sort of phylopatry to a particular area. You know, there may be a bunch of things driving that, though, right? Harvest may be driving that, right? The ability of hunters to travel and a lot more hunting across a lot more areas of the country, potentially. And so there's some potential biases in that, but we're pretty confident, you know, and we're excited about, you know, the data that we have is we think is pretty solid. That we have, you know, high levels of phylopatry. We have transmitter birds that have had devices on for 3 years that are coming back to the same area. You know, lots of little sort of anecdotal little pieces of information. I had, a guy's son killed a widgeon drake. You guys may have talked about this before, but a drake widgeon was killed 2 or 3 years after we banded it. I mean, feet away from where we caught it, because this is a flooded timber that floods out into this little grass CRP field. And they, you know, we were catching these ducks right on the edge of that timber, and the ducks were landing in that grass field and swimming into there and getting the bait. And that's where we were catching them right there. So we had widgeon, and the hunter was standing on the edge of that field. And I mean, I'm talking literally 10, 15 feet away from where we caught this thing 2 or 3 years later, that bird was harvested there. So it's not just happening with mallards. The shift north is real. There's statistical support for it. We have no evidence of any sort of longitudinal shift to the east or west. Interestingly, though, that we need to look into further, that we're learning from our transmitters. We never know this without transmitters. You know, when we had this hard freeze this year, we were expecting, we had a bunch of devices out in Missouri and in Arkansas. We were expecting these birds to hunker down for a few days, right? Energetically, it's better for these birds to hunker down and not spend any energy. Just hunker down, stay there, and try to get through that ice event. It costs them more energy to actually leave, go try to find somewhere else with open water. And when they leave, they're spending calories trying to get there. So they got to eat when they get there. So it's just best to hunker down a few days if they can. Well, that's what they did for a few days. But what we've seen with our Arkansas birds, we had a couple birds shift south, but not a ton. The Missouri birds, the ones that moved, I had one bird maybe move south, but we had numerous birds in Missouri that went east. So they went over the Illinois River Valley out of Missouri. So they're not, these birds that were impacted by an ice event, these are the ones that we're standing in the woods in Arkansas hoping that we get this push of birds because here comes this ice event. And they migrated east. They did not come south at all. So that was really, really interesting piece of information that we learned from these devices this year. In terms of impacts of weather and that sort of thing on, you know, on our migration events that we were hoping to see at some point.
Based off that and that statement and this, you know, this was a significant cold front for us here in recent memory, you know, not only in severity, but how long it stuck around. Cause a lot of times, you know, it's just, it comes and goes and you don't see a lot of push of ducks, but there were obviously a lot of people banking on these ducks to move and it didn't really, I don't think it really happened. And the Game and Fish's aerial surveys kind of bore that out that, you know, we were a pretty pitiful number, lowest since they started flying the current transects that they're on. So it was the lowest since 2009 or something when they did the late January survey. So I say all that to get to this, based on what you're seeing with your, you know, transmitter data and maybe what you think anecdotally or hypothesis wise, whatever it is, are the modern day mallards, are they really moving with cold fronts? Are they moving when they move based on the moon and equinoxes and calendar, you know, the calendar migrators? Are ducks really moving with weather anymore?
Not the ones that we want to move with weather, right? We get the ducks, they're going, right? We get this other sort of cohort of ducks that probably moves with weather, but we may not be seeing it anymore. I mean, this banding season in Missouri, we caught 3 juveniles to every 1 adult. 3 juvenile mallards to every 1 adult mallard. In Arkansas, it was 1-to-1. Way more adult ducks in Arkansas, way more juveniles in Missouri. Why are those juvenile mallards not? Those young birds are the ones, you know, hunters like me, like the young dumb birds, and that we don't see them anymore. So, I mean, when we were up there banding in Missouri, as soon as that ice event hit, we had 3 juvenile ducks to every 1 adult. And in Arkansas, when we were banding at the same time, we had 1-to-1. So that juvenile population, in my opinion, is staying in more in the mid-continent or in the mid-latitude states. And we aren't seeing them down here. And I think it's probably driven mostly by climate. I think, you know, there's another hypothesis that may be also slightly driven by genetics, that we're getting, you know, we're getting genetic change in a population where more and more of them are using agricultural fields and that sort of thing, opposed to the ones that historically used the woods. And part of that is the genetic research that goes on at University of Texas, El Paso, that we've been contributing samples for and they've been analyzing. And so one thing I'm really interested to see is of the transmitter birds we put out in Missouri and Arkansas this year, what proportion of those Missouri birds have game farm genetics in them versus the ones in Arkansas that we put out here. So what are there differences in the proportion of game farm genetics in the populations of the birds in Missouri and Arkansas? Or maybe there's not. There may not be. There's certainly more juveniles in Missouri, you know, at the end of January, beginning of February than there are in Arkansas. Is there, what's causing that sort of younger cohort of birds to stay north even when the weather events hit? Is it genetics? Is it changing climates? Is it the lack of, are we just not have enough food for them down here, and generations of birds, two or three generations of birds haven't come down here, so now they just stop coming down here? You know, I don't know.
Well, that's what makes you worry, is these adult birds that are coming to Arkansas, once they perish, you know, whatever way they died, I mean, are we going to start seeing a smaller and smaller and smaller, you know, generational number come here? And it sounds like it's already happening.
Right.
It's kind of scary.
Yeah, that is scary. And that really is, when I give these talks, I always have this slide about the white-fronted geese in here, because, you know, the white-fronted goose used to historically winter across coastal Texas, and all the things that happened to the landscape down there, right? They get long-term drought. They had several years of drought where the rice farmers were restricted on how much water they use. So they couldn't pay for the water. They couldn't use the water. So they couldn't farm rice. So you get rid of the rice, put sugarcane in the ground. We're continuously losing the saltwater marshes down there. We get inundation of the saltwater into the freshwater marshes now. That saltwater in these freshwater marshes is killing the root tubers that the geese went down there for. White-fronted geese are grubbing. They're grubbers. They're evolved to eating root tubers out of the mud. That's what they went down there for. And the grain was their Snickers bar. You know, they didn't go down there for the grain. They're grubbers, but they appear to be changing. I mean, now that whole distribution of birds, because their marshes are gone from inundation, from no rice, less water on the landscape, urban sprawl and urban development down there, the whole wad of geese now is up in the Mississippi Valley and now all the way clean up into Indiana. And so my example is, all the things that we've done to the landscape down there that impacted that white-fronted goose and made them shift their distribution, what happens if that happens to mallards? Because we got less water on the landscape, we got more fall tillage, we got unhealthy forests, we got, you know, all on and on and on and on. And so it can happen. And now we got this whole game farm genetic influence on wild mallard populations. And if we continuously grow in the proportion of game farm genetics that are in genes that are in these populations, we may be in a world of hurt.
Well, let me ask this, because I'm sure there's some folks riding on the road right now screaming at the radio. Elaborate a little more on the northern shift. We kind of tiptoed around it here the last few minutes, but this northern shift of band recoveries, I know a lot of people may read more into that than what there is, but explain that a little deeper as far as what you're saying and how far this shift is. Because we heard a lot of that this year, you know, that, oh, we're not seeing ducks because they're all north of us. Well, no, we weren't seeing them because the population was so low. But
So on a statistical standpoint, when you're looking at the trend from 1960 to 2024, you're looking at a line that has a particular angle, like the roof of your house, right? That angle is like a couple of degrees, right? But it's statistically supported that there's not tons of noise in the data to where, you know, where the trend north is not, you know, it is supported by the data, is statistically supported by the analysis, and it, you know, it's 2 or 3 degrees of a change on average north. And and so, but think about, we're using band recoveries And so if all the hunters quit hunting Arkansas and they go up and hunt Missouri every year, and a bunch of more people go up into Missouri, and all of a sudden Missouri harvest, you know, we're killing more bands up there. And so part of the band recovery distribution and part of some of the biases that band recovery presents us is that it depends on where the hunters go. And so now there's so many more hunters going up into the Dakotas, all right, to hunt, particularly those years. So for instance, all these hunters, we all go up to Canada and hunt, and then we get COVID, and then now we can't go across the border. So now we, instead of going to Canada, we go to North Dakota. And so we go to North Dakota and kill our birds instead of Canada. So now all of a sudden that those couple of years, we see a further shift south in the harvest distribution for September, because now we went to, you know, North Dakota instead of Canada. And so there's some things like hunter effort that potentially biases the true inferences that can come out of these data. Are these populations truly shifting north? Or, and so I guess maybe that's what you wanted me to talk about, is that we have support that our band recovery, our mean average band recovery is moving north. Are we losing the core of the winter area? No. But we are seeing more and more birds, and probably less of birds harvested in Arkansas. And so it's, in my opinion, is condensing more into the mid-latitude states.
Yeah, that makes sense. With more, I'd have to look at Missouri's numbers. I don't know if they've had this exponential growth in hunters. I doubt it. Mm-hmm. But they do have people that are doing a lot better job managing habitat. And with that, yeah, their harvest rates increase. They have better seasons. So, you can definitely make the inference that some of the ducks that were on their way to Arkansas are getting shot before they get to make it here. So they may have returned to where, you know, area where they got banded, but maybe they didn't make it because somebody shot them in Missouri or somebody shot them, you know, wherever that is. So that makes a lot of sense. And I guess that'll bear out over time, and we'll see what happens. Cause I've shot one of your bands the last two seasons, and both of them were very close, you know, within less than 10 miles from where you banded them. Like one was at Wild Wing, one was banded at Wild Wings, and one was banded at Stick Pond. And I'm right in between the two of them, pretty equal distance. So, you know, those ducks are making it back. And your statistics bear that out, but yeah. You know, we're getting kind of towards the end. But you had an interesting slide in that presentation that I thought was pretty telling in what some of the transmitter data is telling you about pressure and duck movements. Especially the one slide that really caught my eye was the one that was the how far they will fly range wise in kind of peaks early to mid December, and then it starts to tail as you get later in January, and they stop foraging as much. Is that a pressure thing? Is that because they show up here and they find a place that's fairly safe, plenty to eat, plenty of place to loaf, and so they kind of settle in? Because we have a contingency of hunters that just completely believe January is the greatest hunting of all time, and I don't know that the numbers bear that out. I don't know that success really bears that out. And can you tie that to this movement or lack of movement that you're seeing in January? Because if the ducks don't move, you're gonna have a hard time hunting them and shooting them.
Yes. Okay. So we modeled mean flight distance for a particular day. How many meters does a bird fly in one day? And the peak is, you know, really around December 1st to the December, by the 15th, December 1st to the 15th. And then from there, it decreases pretty rapidly, which means those birds after December 15th are really starting to just hunker down and fly a lot less. distance during a particular day. The reason for that study was really to look at the use of birds around sanctuaries, particularly related to hunting policy. And so the idea was that public land says, hey, you can only hunt till you got to be off the site by 12 or quit hunting by 12 o'clock. What's the objective of that from a policy standpoint? To me, if they're worried about hunter opportunity, which is why we manage AHM, if we're worried about maximizing hunting policy, why are we shutting the hunting down at noon? Why can't you're stopping that kid from getting out of school at 3 o'clock and running into the woods and hunting the last hour and a half on public land? Now that kid can't do that because you got him shut down at noon. Now he has to wait till the weekend. So if you want to increase, in my opinion, if the policy or stop hunting on public land is at noon is related to the resource, then we expect the resource to be used in the woods in the afternoon, right? And so let's shut it down at noon so the ducks can go in there in the afternoon. Well, they're not doing it. Our data does not show an increased use of the hunted areas on public land during the afternoon. They're not doing it. And so most of those flights are obviously right around daylight and dawn and dusk, like we would expect. If that policy is set to maximize, to allow the ducks in there in the afternoon, then we would expect to see them. But if that's why the policy is there and it's not working, then why are we maintaining that regulation to minimize hunting opportunity? And so our idea really was to look at that question, is that policy, are we achieving that policy by, are we achieving the goal of that policy? And our data says, no, we're not. And so in that process, we were looking at, you know, mean flight distances and all that. And again, around that December 1st to the 15th is where their flights are, there's more flights in a day and there are longer duration flights. And it may be, and it, from November 1st till the time we catch them until December 1st, it rapidly increases. So they're constantly moving more and more and more into December. And so if we think about it ecologically, is that in November, there's food everywhere, right? The birds get here, there's food everywhere. Hunting season hasn't started yet. Birds can hunker down, not really have to go anywhere because they really can sit on any wetland that's actually has water and get all the resources they need. Hunting season comes in, they start getting ran around a bit more, right? Out of the few places that actually have water, now the birds are getting ran around. The birds got to kind of move around a bit to find the food and resources and cover and, you know, and protection and all that stuff they need. So it kind of ramps up. After December 15th, it rapidly starts to decrease where there's probably more water on the landscape at that point, and there's more little places for the ducks to tuck in and just hide and just not move until February 1st. And that magical day when they all just show up in your woods, when you're like, they hadn't been here all year and now the woods is full. Well, they're somewhere close by. They just didn't migrate here, you know, last night, I promise. They're here. They're just hunkered down and not moving.
Yeah, and a lot of those ag fields, you know, start getting drained January 30th. So a lot of that habitat goes away, too. So I think mm-hmm. they get congregated as much as anything. But they do. They definitely come out from under a log or wherever it is they've been surviving. And they're very good at making a living surviving. We see it with those white front units. They get boringly predictable. I mean, same pattern every day, clockwork. And, you know, usually it's rain on the landscape, water in the landscape that gets them out of that pattern and makes them susceptible to harvest. But we're talking about movement and all this stuff. Have you seen any correlation to full moons and duck movement, behavior, patterns? What are you seeing on that front?
Yeah, we did a really neat study with Delta Waterfowl funded a few years back, and we had teal and widgeon and mallards marked. We were looking at basically total daily movement distance associated with the moon illumination. So, you know, at a full moon, basically that rate of illumination went from 0 to 1. So the closer you got to 1, the fuller that moon. So pre-hunting season, that November, basically the November full moon when we had birds marked, there was really no change in their daily movement patterns during the full moon that happened before the hunting season. Probably the one that got the birds here in the first place, maybe that late October, early November full moon. There was no, the daily movement distance at, you know, zero moon illumination to 100% moon illumination didn't change. The slope of that line is flat. The post-hunting season in February, after the hunting season's done, that line's flat. Like, they moved the same amount with full moon as they did with a new moon, which was really interesting pre and post season. The full moon during the hunting season is the slope of your roof. And so when there's zero moon illumination, they didn't move a whole bunch. But when the full moon, it shows that slope of that line is really, really steep. As the moon got brighter and brighter and brighter and brighter, these birds are moving more and more and more and more at night during the hunting season. So the hunt season, the pressure of hunting season directly is why those birds move during the moonlight. They don't they don't want to move at night, but they can because they can see where they're going to land somewhere safe, and move and access different resources. So 100%, in my opinion, 100% of the reason why birds are moving during a full moon is because of the pressure of hunting season. Because when you take that pressure away pre and post hunting season, it doesn't change their behavior at all.
Yeah, that's interesting. We know it. Especially this handful of years that keep kind of going by and by, we start seeing more ducks. Afternoon hunt and not see but a handful of ducks, and then at 5:30, 5:45, they're literally everywhere. And then who knows what happens after it gets dark? You can't see them anymore. But being able to tie that together, I just grew up always having a really difficult time where we hunted. Full moon, you might as well not even go. And this was long before pressuring became a catchphrase. This was in the 80s, 90s, early 2000s. It's full moon, just forget about it. And that's the main reason I figured out how to hunt speckle-belly geese, or took that task on 15 years ago or whatever it was, because I was tired of having days, 5-6 days where the moon got really big and bright that duck hunting wasn't happening. And the geese don't seem to be quite as do quite the disappearing act that ducks do. They still act a little goofy, but they're still you still got a chance. And we just didn't even have a chance on the mallards when the full moon came out. So, yeah. One of the things I've advocated for and with the commissioners and setting frameworks is maybe take a look at the calendar and see if we can't back into some dates where the full moon is during a split and that would improve hunter opportunity exponentially, because that's not taken into consideration now. And oftentimes, especially in December where we've had these long splits, and then you throw a full moon on top of it and you maybe have half the month of December that you can be eligible to hunt and have a chance. Cause I just don't know a lot of people that have much success during a full moon. I don't think it's isolated to me and my story. But it'd be interesting to start looking at season frameworks and dates and throw that full moon in the middle of a split and give us a chance the days that the season is actually open. Cause man, it sure is tough during a full moon.
Yep. Well, I mean, you know, it's not groundbreaking science, but it's questions that come up in the field. And so this is what drives our research. We're trying to address questions. We're trying to provide the data that to address the concerns that we have about our resources from the hunter standpoint, which is why my interaction with the hunters in my banding program, why I take some volunteers and get them engaged off and on. Like, without me being engaged with the hunters and the landowners and the agency folks and all that in the field, I don't always see the questions and concerns that's going on out there. And we have the data to answer these questions. And we know it's not groundbreaking science that, hey, ducks move during a full moon. But at least we have the support now, right? I mean, we got the graphs. We have the analysis. We have a solid support of these things that people are seeing in the field that should be taken to the agency, right, to help them make better, or to help them to make their management decisions, their policy decisions. And that's what, for a long, long time in our field, that's where we've had a disconnect, is the agencies and the science. You know, they're the mostly what's driving historically, not now, what mostly driving agencies' decisions is politics, right? And the stakeholders' engagement and involvement and their concerns and who's getting what vote and this and that, right? We're moving the needle. We are moving the needle in agencies to where they're leaning more and more and more towards data. Some agencies are faster than others to adopt the data and say, listen, this is what the data says. These are the policies that we think we can influence from these data. And but there is a balance. We got stakeholders in their ear on one side, and they got scientists in their ear on the other side. And so they got to find that balance where they trust and support the data to support the decisions that they're making, and back them up and say, hey, I know maybe this ain't the most popular thing and hunters are going to be frustrated, but this is what the data says and this is what we need to do for the resource. And I think we're moving that needle. If you know the history of state wildlife agencies, you know, in the past, you know where I'm going with this conversation, but we're moving that needle, and I think it's getting better.
Well, that's encouraging, because you can't really be selective. And when you apply science and when you do things for, you know, hunter benefit or whatever it is, and kind of ignore the science. And it seems like sometimes, whether it's on a federal level or on a state level, and it's not just in Arkansas, we follow stuff in some contiguous states pretty closely and have friends and relationships, and they scratch their heads sometimes on what their state agency's doing. So take this as I'm pointing all the fingers at Arkansas Game and Fish, because I'm not, because it happens everywhere. And hopefully this science piece will just, or this data piece coming out of the science, will start gaining more ground, and we start making decisions that it, because if you really think about it, if we choose resource first with the stuff we do, the hunting on the backside, the hunting will benefit on the backside of that. Not the inverse. If we just do everything, you know, what's best for the hunter and best opportunity for the hunter, then the resource is going to suffer at that. And we got to find, like you said, there's some middle ground. But when your population's down like it is, and things are trending that this particular season coming up is probably not going to be that great based on what we're seeing on the breeding grounds, maybe it's just skewed more towards the resource and less about the hunter. And let's start building for the future when it does bounce back. You've said it earlier, the mallards will make a turn, and they can do it pretty quick. But how deep a hole are we going to dig before it does turn around? Well, Doug, we appreciate you coming back on the show. We obviously welcome the opportunity to have you on here, you know, a couple times a year because of this, just some of the stuff you're doing. It's so enlightening and kind of connects a lot of dots for a lot of people. But you know, keep doing what you're doing, and we appreciate your efforts to try to learn what's going on with these ducks versus all these conspiracy theories and everything else that we hear and see.
Yeah, I thank you all for this, your support and program, and highlighting some of the stuff we do. And you know, I don't know, I'm passionate about the resource, and I'm really driven and passionate about the students that come out of our programs, and just happy, you know. that's how I'm counting my chickens at the end of my career, is the students that are impacting our resource out there. And so I think it's a valuable, the programs we do are really focused around, you know, just the science and our students. And I thank you all for reaching out to me again, and maybe we'll get together in a duck blind someday. So
yeah that'd be great. And I do think, and that's an important point to kind of reiterate, is you are training the next set of biologists. They're going to work for these agencies, and to bring some of your methodologies and efforts and style and everything else you want to add up, that, you know, maybe that'll influence some future, you know, policy decisions and things like that. I mean, time will tell, obviously, but I think that's a key piece besides all the stuff you're doing with the ducks. It's with the future of waterfowl science that's going to be play a pretty big role in where this resource and where the sport ends up. So, yeah,
that's right.
Well, guys, go ahead, Kason.
Sorry, I was going to say that's right. I mean, if we're not careful, you know, we can lose the direction and decision making of the sport to non-consumptive, you know, biologists. So the education, and especially the hunters and educating hunters that become biologists, is important to what we want and what we desire as consumers. So I think you're doing great work there, Doug, and I appreciate it. I know a lot of other people do too.
Yes, sir. Appreciate you.
All right, that's a wrap on another episode of The Standard Sportsman. Kason and I appreciate y'all listening. And, of course, we appreciate our sponsors, too. Those guys have been great to us and getting us off the ground and then sticking with us as we've gained an audience and built this thing up. So please check us out online at thestandardsportsman.com. You can check us out on social media at thestandardsportsman. And be sure to tell all your friends about what we talk about on here and get them listening, too. Thanks, guys, and we'll catch you next time.
Light Boots, the lightest pair of knee boots you're ever going to find. Weighing in at just 13 ounces each, putting on a pair of light boots is truly a jaw-dropping experience.